All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, Human Anatomy, and it is March 2nd. Your next test is a week from today, your lecture test. Some of you might have a practicum between now and then. So check out the schedule. Sign-in sheet is going around. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And we're going to start muscles today. Now, this chapter is not on the lecture test. All right, so we're starting new material for the third lecture test. Your material for the second lecture test stops with joints. And we've covered all of that pretty well. Plus, you get to review that in lab very nicely as well. All right, something happened this week which was different than previous weeks in Blackboard. It started misbehaving to where when you would click on begin to take a quiz, some students experienced that Blackboard would reload the quiz page, and then about a half a second later reload the quiz page, and then about a half a second after that it would reload the quiz page, and about a half a second after that it would reload it again and again and again and again, and then finally it would time out and give an error and they could never take the quiz. And so I sent out some emails and a number of people said, oh, well, yeah, that happens with Internet Explorer. Well, I've never really experienced it before, so I could give you a heads up. And maybe that is true, maybe not true. So I recommended that people download Mozilla Firefox and put the link for you as an announcement also in Blackboard. So download Firefox and use that to take your quiz. Now, Firefox doesn't work with all the modules in Blackboard that I have you go to, like the Essential Study Partner. You do need Internet Explorer to use that particular program. But that's okay because you can have multiple browsers open in different windows, and that should be fine on your computer. So that's what happened. If you had problems with that quiz, then we'll have to work out some kind of detail so that you can go back and take that quiz if you were experiencing that. But that's a new feature as far as I know in Blackboard. So what is recommended is what? Mozilla Firefox right here. So you should see this little symbol. That's a free, easy download for you to do and install on your computer. Some people have used Chrome and have not experienced that problem. Only with Internet Explorer. I don't know why, because I think Blackboard was purchased by Microsoft. And so I find that very ironic that one Microsoft program won't work with another one, but other programs will work with Blackboard. That's kind of funny. So make sure you're aware of that for the next quiz. And as a matter of fact, for the next week assignment, start early to make sure that your browser is working with the quiz program. So if you wait until like 10 o'clock at night, then probably I won't have any helpful suggestions for you. All right, so try to get it done early. And it doesn't matter if you complete it or not. Always click the Save and Submit button, and then you can go back in. Even if you don't answer any questions, just always click Save and Submit, and then Blackboard will let you go back in and retake the quiz. Numerous times, right? But if you close your browser or close the window that the quiz is in, then Blackboard might not let you go back in because it thinks you're still taking the quiz and will give you that paper and pencil symbol in the grade book, which last week I couldn't clear manually, but now I can. So I'll be able to straighten that out for you this week. All right, so does anybody have any questions over bones before we move on to the next topic? We're pretty good with bones. There's a few items there that you have to know about, which are good for you to know because it will help you with the next chapter coming up, which is muscle, and the one after that, which will be nervous system. All right, so let's get started with the next chapter. And the next chapter, what is the next chapter? 9, perhaps? It is 10. Okay. So we want introduction to muscles. Indeed, that is what we want. Okay. All right, so basic introduction to muscle. This chapter, we don't just memorize the names and locations of muscles. That's something that's important for you to do in lab, right? But we're going to talk about what is muscle good for, maybe how it contracts a little bit, and some other introductory material. Okay, so muscle, remember, is one of the four basic kinds of tissues in your body, which are what? Epithelium, connective tissue, muscle, and nervous tissue. And so the functions of muscle first, movement is real important. A muscle usually has two ends. The two ends are attached to two different bones, and the job of muscle is to contract. So it is specialized to shorten or contract. So when a muscle contracts, it pulls these two bones together through some kind of articulation. Usually that's what happens, right? So it produces movement of the skeletal system. And the only kinds of muscles that are attached to your skeleton are what we call skeletal muscles, and those are under voluntary control. So you can move your skeleton around using those muscles. As a matter of fact, that's the only thing that you have control of in your whole body. You don't have control over the other kinds of effectors, which are cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. You don't have any control over that whatsoever. All right, but skeletal muscles are not important just for motion, but also for posture. Because, for instance, right now you're sitting in a chair, your head is nice and erect, and you're writing some notes, looking at the screen. What were to happen to you if all of a sudden all the muscles in your body relaxed, all the skeletal muscles? Yeah, your head would bounce off the table and then probably bounce off the chair and then off the floor, right? So muscles, even though you're not moving, are important for maintaining posture, right? And that protects your body. So maintenance of posture is very important. Joint stabilization is another important reason. So certain joints can only perform certain kinds of motion. Some are purely hinge joints, like the knee can flex and extend, but you don't ever want to abduct or adduct at the knee. Right, because that means that right at the knee, right, so if the joint between my fingertips is your knee and anterior is facing you, your knee can flex and extend, but you don't ever want your knee to do that, which is abduct. And you don't ever want your knee to do that, which is adduction. I have to turn the volume down maybe just a little bit. All right, so muscles protect that knee joint so that it doesn't produce any of those abnormal motions. And then another function of muscle is that it generates body heat. Because what's the relation of the temperature of your body compared to the room right now? Is it the same? What is the temperature of your body? It is higher than the room, right? So yeah, if you wanted to say 98.6, it certainly is not anywhere 90 degrees in here. So in order for you to stay alive, your body temperature is above room temperature in this particular case. And where that heat comes from is through muscle contraction. All right, so those are some important functions. Some characteristics of muscle. All right, we said that it is specialized to contract, but it has some other characteristics besides contractility. It is excitable, which means that sometimes it is not contracting, and with the proper stimulus, it begins to contract, and that's under your voluntary control. It is extensible, which means that you can stretch a muscle. Muscle not only contracts, but if you pull on a muscle, it can actually stretch to some degree without damage. Right? And that, under certain circumstances, can make the muscle stronger. And, of course, athletes use that because what do they like to do when they're warming up? They like to stretch muscles to make them stronger. And then the last thing is, after you stretch a muscle and let go, guess what it has a tendency to do? Go back to its original length. We call that elasticity. So muscles can do all of that kind of stuff. All right, so the three kinds of muscle we said are voluntary, which is skeletal, two kinds of involuntary muscle, which is cardiac and smooth, and you know what these look like underneath the microscope. You understand the histology of those. Okay, skeletal muscle and smooth muscle, because they are long and narrow, they kind of look like a fiber underneath the microscope. So people use that term to describe a muscle cell. So a muscle cell and a muscle fiber are exactly the same kinds of objects. And I'll use that terminology in here interchangeably. So you just have to follow what I'm saying. All right, so let's look at the basic organization of a skeletal muscle. And we have that on this slide right here. All right, so slide on the left, you can see what a typical muscle looks like. What connects a muscle to a bone is what we call tendon. And you know what tendon looks like underneath the microscope? It's just dense, regular connective tissue. What's the chemical that makes a tendon up? What's the primary chemical in there? It is? And since it's connective tissue, it's extracellular. What's the name of that extracellular fiber that makes a tendon really strong? It doesn't stretch. It's not stretchable. It resists stretching. And it's not elastic either. It is collagen, right? So collagen is the chemical or the fiber that makes up tendons. So a tendon is a muscle-to-bone connection. So when this muscle right here shortens or contracts, it will pull, it will exert tension on the muscle via the tendon. All right, so this right here, sometimes we call this the belly of the muscle. It's just the thickest part of a muscle, for instance, like the biceps brachii or triceps on the posterior side of the arm. And surrounding the whole muscle is a membrane. Do you remember what we call the membrane that surrounds a bone? The periosteum, okay? But in this particular case, we're not going to say osteo because that's bone. We're going to say mesium. Mesium stands for muscle. Cardium stands for the heart muscle, right? But mesium just stands for skeletal muscle. Epimysium is the connective tissue that surrounds the whole muscle, and it's continuous with the connective tissue of the tendon. All right, but then if we look inside of a muscle, if we cut it, we see some other structures. We see a bunch of bundles right here. So here's a muscle bundle. We just pull one bundle out. Sometimes we call that a fascicle. A fascicle and a bundle are exactly the same kind of thing. Right? And it has a connective tissue surrounding it as well. And that's what we call the perimysium. So a perimysium surrounds every fascicle or muscle bundle. And then if we look inside of a fascicle, what do we see? Do you see any other structures inside of a fascicle? There's even structures inside every fascicle. So a fascicle has building blocks to it, and the basic building block of a fascicle is this structure right here. Right? And now we're looking at a cell. And what's another name for a cell? A fiber, right? So a muscle fiber and muscle cell are exactly the same kind of thing. And these skeletal muscles are very long and linear. One characteristic is that they have numerous nuclei, because at one time during development, a muscle fiber, right, is actually maybe hundreds or thousands of individual very short muscle cells that fuse together into this very long tubular kind of structure that we call a muscle fiber. All right, and there is a connective tissue sheath around every muscle fiber as well. And that's not the cell membrane, but it's actually some connective tissue, and that's what we call the endomysium. So you got three kinds of connective tissues surrounding muscles. The one that surrounds the entire muscle is called the epimysium. The one that surrounds a fascicle, right, is the perimysium, and the one that surrounds every single cell is the endomysium. And all of these fuse together as a muscle gets shorter and becomes a tendon. So all these connective tissue sheaths are connected to each other at the ends of a muscle. All right, so I do want you to know the building blocks of a muscle. So far what we looked at, the smallest building block is a cell or a fiber. And if we put a bunch of cells or fibers together, what do we get? We get a fascicle. And if we put a bunch of fascicles together, we get something that we call a muscle that we're going to name. All right, so but if we look inside of a muscle fiber, is it homogeneous? Is it just all like one grayscale? Or do you see structures inside of a cell, inside of a fiber? Yeah, I even see structures inside of a muscle fiber. So we're going to have to understand the building blocks of a muscle fiber as well. All right, and I don't think we're going to do that this time. No, I think we're done looking at it now. But we're going to look at that sooner or later in this chapter. All right, so let's talk about some other things about more gross anatomy. Right, to see inside of a cell, we would have to use a microscope that's more histology. So let's stay more with just some gross anatomy for a little bit, which is this diagram right here. All right, so those of you that have taken your practicum, you probably know this already. What is this structure right here? That's a bone called the humerus, right? And then what is this bone right here? You see the trochlear notch. There's the olecranon process. So now you know this is the ulna. And then here's the radius. Oh, what's the name of this process right here on the ulna? That is the coronoid process, right? So here's the olecranon process, coronoid process right here. Here's a muscle that we see it has two ends. It is attached to the humerus about mid-diaphysis, and then it's also attached to the ulna right here. And what's the job of a muscle? What does it do? It contracts, right? It doesn't push. It just always contracts when it's excited, all right, by some nerve signal that's going to it. So it's going to contract, and so it's going to shorten the distance between these two points on these two different bones, and as a result, right, the elbow is going to bend, the hand is going to move up to the shoulder. What do we call that motion? When the angle between the humerus and the bones in the forearm decreases, what do we call that? That is flexion, right? We learned that in the last lecture. Okay. All right, so this particular muscle, actually all muscles, generally have two ends. One end is called the origin and the other is called the insertion. And the way we figure out which end is which is that the origin is attached to a bone that does not move very much when the muscle contracts. The other end of the muscle is connected to a bone that moves a lot when the muscle contracts. So the end that moves is what we call the insertion. So here we see the origin. This brachialis right here is pretty similar to a biceps brachii, and you're kind of familiar with the biceps. When the biceps contracts, that causes flexion of the forearm or flexion at the elbow right here, right? And so when the biceps or brachialis contracts, what part of your body is moving? Is it your arm or your forearm that's moving? The forearm. So the attachment point to the forearm is what we call the insertion. The attachment point to the arm is not moving. We call that the origin. All right, so here is a really good example of origin and insertion. This is a really good example. Sometimes both bones move, but the insertion is always going to be on the bone that moves the most. Okay, so that's how we got origin and insertion. Some muscles are attached to bones with a very short tendon. And as a matter of fact, it almost looks like the muscle is attached directly to the bone. Right, so we call that a direct attachment. But there's always going to be at least a small length of tendon between a muscle and a bone. And then there's an indirect attachment where you might have a really long tendon, as in this condition right here, as the brachialis inserts into the ulna. That's a very long tendon, so that's an indirect attachment. We're going to see even much longer tendons in various other parts of the body. All right, so that's some gross anatomy. Okay, now we can look at some fine structure that makes up a muscle cell. So where are we looking? All right, so here is the whole muscle with the epimysium around it. We see fascicles that are surrounded by perimysium, and then the building block of a fascicle is a muscle fiber with the endomysium surrounding that. But now if we look inside of the cell, we can even see smaller structures. What do we call structures, small structures inside of a cell that have a specialized function? Organelles. Yeah, like name another organelle. Mitochondria. What does a mitochondria do? It makes ATP for us. Okay, so these you can consider organelles for contraction or shortening, right? And all of these are really long tubular structures that we call myofibrils. That wasn't on the cell illustration that you learned about already. So this is a new kind of organelle, and typically people don't talk about it as an organelle, but you probably should think about it as an organelle. And it's specialized for contraction. Oops. Let's put that away and this away right here. So what does a myofibril look like? All right, so here we have the endomysium that surrounds every particular cell, and we see the cell membrane right here. The cell membrane has got a different name when it surrounds a skeletal muscle. It's called the sarcolemma. So the sarcolemma and cell membrane or plasma membrane are the exact same thing. So here we see that it's cut, reflected away a little bit, And what do we see a lot of in this particular fiber? You see a lot of striations. Yeah, I see some dark bands and some light bands, and they repeat over and over again. What else do you see a lot of? You see a lot of myofibrils, the tubular structures, right? These you can consider the organelles for contraction. And what else do you see a lot of? I see a lot of nuclei here. Somebody else did too. That's good, because skeletal muscle is what? Multinucleated. Because it was at one time, what, hundreds or thousands of cells. The other thing you see a lot of are these mitochondria right here, because muscle needs a lot of ATP for contraction. All right, so the building block of a fiber is a myofibril. And furthermore, if we look at this myofibril that's been pulled out of the fiber, do you see any structures inside the myofibril? You see anything, or is it just like all one grayscale? Or do you see structures inside of a myofibril? You see anything in there? Yeah. I see some really long lines, and then I see some really narrow lines. I see some light bands and some dark bands. So I even see some structure within a myofibril. All right, so let's look at a myofibril. So we'll pull a myofibril out. Okay, so here is one myofibril, and if you put a bunch of myofibrils together, what do you get? You get a muscle fiber. Okay, if you put a bunch of muscle fibers together, what do you get? A fascicle, and if you put a bunch of fascicles together, what do you get? You get the whole muscle. All right, so let's start with the whole muscle and go back the other way. If you have a whole muscle, what's the building block of a whole muscle? It's a fascicle. Building block of a fascicle is a muscle. Fascicle is a muscle fiber or a muscle cell. What's the building block of a muscle fiber or muscle cell? That is this thing right here, a myofibril. But now, if we look at this myofibril, what do we see? Even more stuff inside of it, right? But now we're getting really small. You'd almost need to have an electron microscope to see this kind of detail. All right, so let's look at the building blocks of a myofibril. And don't forget, this is like an organelle for contraction. All right, these dark bands are what we call the A bands. And that's pretty easy to remember because that vowel A is in dark, right? That's not how it was named, but that will work for this class. And the I band is a light band. And that's okay because there's an I in light, so that's really easy to remember. All right, so you have a dark band and a light band, and they, okay, change positions as you move from one end of the myofibril to another. All right, then we have the zigzag line right here and here. We call those Z-discs. All right, call them Z-discs, not because it forms a zigzag right here, but because those are the endpoints of the structural and functional unit of contraction inside of a muscle. All right, so we looked at structural and functional unit before. I think we asked you, what's the structural and functional unit of life? That's a cell, right? So you can really understand something about life if you know how a cell is put together and how it functions, and we approach that from understanding the different organelles. Different organelles have different functions. Okay, so here is the structural and functional unit, and it has one dark band in it and half of a light band. So this is what we call a sarcomere, from this Z-disc to this Z-disc over here. Right smack in the middle, we have something called an M-line, which I guess probably shouldn't be so confusing, because what's that part of mitosis where everything just lines up right in the middle? Metaphase, right? So M just kind of signifies being right smack in the middle, all right? And between these blue lines right here, there's another little band that's a little bit lighter than this dark band, right? Where we have the blue lines and red lines overlapping, it's a lot darker than in the middle, so sometimes we call that the H zone. It's on either side of the M line. All right, so these are some of the components that make up a sarcomere. All right, and if we look at it on end, guess what? We see some more structures. And these structures are continuous with these dark lines, the dark red lines and blue lines that make up a sarcomere. So we're going to understand something about these things as well. These are the proteins, right, that the sarcomere uses to shorten. So we see some thick ones and we see some thin ones. All of these long proteins inside of a myofibril are what we call filaments, myofilaments. All right, and this is pretty much where we're going to stop with understanding muscle. All right, so what's the building block of a myofibril? Those are going to be filaments, myofilaments, and there's two kinds. There's a thick one, which is the red one, and a thin one, which is a blue one right here. All right, and the blue one is what we call actin, and the thick one is what we call myosin. All right, so let's build a muscle. Where are we going to start? We're going to start with the smallest structures, and those are filaments, myofilaments. If we put a bunch of myofilaments together, and remember there's two kinds, there's thick and thin, or what? Myosin and actin. So if we put a bunch of myofilaments together, what do we get? We get the myofibril. And if we put a bunch of myofibrils together, where can I go find that? If we put a bunch of myofibrils together, we get a muscle fiber. And then if we put a bunch of muscle fibers together, we get something, one more slide, that is a fascicle, okay? And then if we put a bunch of fascicles together, we get the muscle. So I want you to be able to go up and down in that different hierarchy. All right, so since we're interested in how muscle shortens, we got to really consider what's happening within a sarcomere right here. Okay, that's really what we're going to be interested in. All right, so what do you have in your notes? You've got all these things. You got a fiber. What's another name for a fiber? That's a cell, right? And then a myofibril is this organ right here for contraction. And then myofilaments make up the myofibrils, right? Okay, so we've talked about most of this stuff right here. Okay, so let's talk about how a muscle shortens a little bit. Where is a good example of that? Oh, let's look at this picture right here. All right, so here is even a nicer illustration of something that is in between these two Z-discs. All right, what did we say is in between Z-discs? The sarcomere, that's the structural and functional unit for contraction. And it's got two important myofilaments, the thick one right here, which is myosin, and thin one, which is actin. And we can see the myosin is attached to the M line, which is right smack in the middle of the sarcomere. But now what about the thin filaments? What are they attached to? Can you see on this diagram? The thin filaments, which are these blue ones right here, they're attached to the Z discs. So they're attached to a little bit different structures within the sarcomere. All right? And the thick ones are thick because they have these processes sticking out of them, and that's what we call cross bridges. All right, so the question that I want you to ask at the end of this discussion is, which one of these proteins actually shortens when the sarcomere shortens? All right, and all sarcomeres within a myofibril will shorten at the same time. All right, so they will all work together. So this sarcomere is going to shorten along with the one that's behind it, along with the one that's in front of it. So all of the sarcomeres in a myofibril will shorten. All right, so here is something that stabilizes the myosin. It kind of looks like a spring, right? And that's what we call a titin filament. But it's not important for contracting or shortening a muscle, producing tension. This is the protein that allows the muscle to stretch. What do we call that? That was one characteristic of muscle. We call that elasticity, okay, or extensibility. It allows the muscle to stretch, and then when tension is released, what does this titin do? It pulls the sarcomere back together. That's what we call elasticity. So titin allows for the extensibility of muscle, allows it to stretch, but then it allows it to go back to its original length after the tension is released. All right, so titin is not important for contraction. What's important for contraction is the actin and myosin right here. All right, so when there is a signal to contract, these cross bridges can reach up and attach to the actin molecule right here. They will attach, and these things kind of act maybe like a little arm. After they attach, they can flex. So here's my arm. All right, what does flexion mean for your arm? What's going to happen? My hand is going to move up to my shoulder, right? So that's flexion. So what happens is that a cross bridge that comes from myosin, which is that thick filament, will grab hold of an actin, and then it's going to start to bend. We're going to, let's just call that flexion, all right? And what's going to happen? It's going to pull the actin molecule so that it slides over the myosin molecule. And then it's going to release, it's going to extend, grab actin again, and it's going to flex so that motion can repeat over and over and over and over again. So there'll be a lot of sliding of actin over a myosin molecule. So let me see if I can show you maybe another example of that. Let's look at these three pictures right here. Okay, so here we have a muscle. So here's a Z-disc. Here's a Z-disc. What do we have between the Z-discs? That's a sarcomere, right? And it's got myosin and actin in there. Here is another sarcomere. Here's a Z-disc and a Z-disc. So here is a sarcomere. And under this condition, the sarcomere is shorter. Can you see that the length from Z-disc to Z-disc on the left is longer than the length between the discs over here on the right? Okay, it is shorter. So this sarcomere has shortened. Now, let's look at the myofilaments. What are the two kinds of myofilaments? We got actin and myosin. So actin is the thin one. Here's the thick one, that's myosin. So let's look at the length of this actin when the muscle is relaxed and compare it to the length of actin when it is contracted. What does the length look like? Does it look the same? Or longer? Or shorter? You know what? You might have to get a ruler out in your book and maybe measure it, but to me, it looks like it's the same length. And too bad I can't like click on it and pull it over here and superimpose it, and it will be exactly the same length, whether the muscle is relaxed or it is contracted over here. All right? Now let's look at a myosin molecule. So here's a myosin molecule. Let's look at the length when the muscle is relaxed and compare it to when the muscle is contracted. And again, all right, if you measure it with a ruler, it should have the same length. All right, so here is a little bit of a paradox. We said that the length of the sarcomere has shortened, but if we look at the length of actin, it's the same, and the length of myosin is the same from before contraction and after. How is it that these Z-discs got closer together? Okay, and then so let me show you using these two markers right here. So let's pretend that the red marker, green marker, right, are actin and myosin. And in the beginning, they have a little bit of overlap right here. All right, so this is during relaxation. So what's the length of these two markers right here? It's almost, what, two markers put together, just a little bit of overlap right here, just a little bit of overlap. All right, and then when the muscle gets excited to contract, what is the difference in this situation over here with the relationship between actin and myosin? Is the overlap the same? No, there's a lot of overlap. So in order to get a lot of overlap, what about these two markers? What do they have to do with each other? They have to slide over each other. Now, what happens to the length from end to end? Did it get shorter? Absolutely. But what about the length of each individual marker? Did it stay the same? Yeah. So the markers don't change shape, it's just the amount of overlap depends how long the sarcomere is, right? So that's what we call the sliding filament model or sliding filament mechanism for muscle contraction. Actin and myosin don't shorten, they just do what? They just slide over each other, and what allows that sliding is the motion of these cross bridges from myosin when it grabs an actin and it articulates. It pulls the actin molecule toward the midline, and when it pulls on the actin, what is it really pulling on? It's pulling on the Z-disc, the termination, the end of a sarcomere, so the ends of a sarcomere are pulled together as actin and myosin slide over each other. All right, so that's what we call the sliding filament mechanism. Okay, so let's look at a little bit different detail of a muscle. Well, I guess I want to say one other thing. So here, this is an exam figure for you, right? So you have to know myosin and actin for sure, and this titin molecule and the Z-disc and this M line right smack in the middle, right? The I-band is this light region that only has actin. And the dark band is where you have myosin. And when a muscle shortens, where is that at? Right here. So here we see a dark band. Here's the light band. And the way they figured this out was because look what happens to the light band when muscle contracts. We look over here. The light band pretty much disappears. It gets really short. Because what's the condition we have when a muscle is contracting? The sarcomere from end to end is taken up almost completely with the myosin filament, which is what the dark band. So these light bands have a tendency to go away because the sarcomere now is just the length of this myosin molecule. All right, so that's probably something important to know. When a muscle contracts, this light band disappears because the Z-discs are pulled together. So let's see about the control mechanism for shortening of these things. All right, so what do we know? Here is the sarcolemma. What's another name for sarcolemma? That's the cell membrane that surrounds the whole muscle cell. And what's another name for a muscle cell? A muscle fiber. So over here we see a nice muscle fiber with a sarcolemma all the way around it. And then we pull out, right, a bunch of myofibrils. So here's a myofibril. And what's the building block of a myofibril? You've got the myofilaments. The thin ones right there are actin, and the thick ones are myosin. All right, so from that one-dimensional picture, now we see a nice three-dimensional picture right here. What's surrounding every myosin molecule? You see a small actin molecule. All right, so when a muscle contracts, it's not just one myosin reaching up and grabbing one actin above it and below it. It's reaching what? A number of actins that completely surround the myosin molecule. And surrounding every actin is what? Numerous myosin molecules. So there's a lot of interactions where these cross bridges, right, will interact with many actin molecules because of the arrangement inside each myofibril. All right, so here we see a sarcomere from Z-disc to Z-disc. And there's a membrane system that surrounds each one of these myofibrils, and this is an endoplasmic reticulum. And if you look at it, what kind of endoplasmic reticulum does it look like? How many kinds are you familiar with? Two. What are they called? Rough and smooth. And which one does this look like? Smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Yeah, it's not rough, because what's the function of rough endoplasmic reticulum? Protein synthesis, right? And that's what we're not concerned with right here. So here is smooth endoplasmic reticulum, and I might not have mentioned the function in skeletal muscle when we were looking at cells, but the function of this smooth endoplasmic reticulum is that it stores calcium. All right, so calcium is just an ion. It's found in really high concentration inside this sarcoplasmic reticulum. Here is an end. So we call this a terminal cistern or terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and there's another terminal cisternae right here that contain a lot of calcium, and running between them is a special kind of tube, and it moves in a transverse direction, right, across the muscle fiber. So if we cut a muscle fiber just like this, we call this a transverse section, as opposed to from end to end would be a longitudinal section. This is just a transverse section right here. So people call this a transverse tubule. And what is this transverse tubule connected up to? We can see it right here. It's connected up to the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And muscles have a lot of similarities to nerves. So there are electrical signals that can flow over the cell surface on the sarcolemma or the cell membrane. And that electrical signal is used to excite each sarcomere in these myofibrils. So you have to be interested to know, how does an electrical signal get from the superficial surface of the cell to deep inside the cell and surrounding all the myofibrils? Well, that's the job of these transverse tubules, or sometimes we just call them T-tubules. So electrical signals flow over the cell membrane, and when it gets to a T-tubule, guess what it does? it makes a 90-degree turn, or part of that signal makes a 90-degree turn, and it goes down deep inside the cell. And that's the only way electrical signals can get inside the cell is through these T-tubules. And then what else does the signal do? It proceeds, bumps into another T-tubule, and it goes to the interior of the cell again. As the electrical signal moves through the T-tubule, it stimulates the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And calcium then diffuses everywhere inside the myofibril, and that causes the cross bridges to grab onto actin and pull actin toward the midline, which is then going to shorten the Z-disc, or the shorten the sarcomere, pulling the Z-discs close together. So let's see what I have on this slide right here. Yeah, we've got Z-disc, M-line, myosin, actin, titin. The myosin head groups can attach to actin to form a cross bridge, and that calcium causes the attachment and then cycling of cross bridges so that it's going to pull actin toward the midline, causing shortening of these myofilaments. Let's take a look at this picture right here. So here is an example of a myosin and an actin. And here I see attachment of a myosin, this little thing that we call that a head group. Right? I see attachment of myosin to actin, and that can happen only under one circumstance that I mentioned. What allows myosin to attach to an actin molecule? That's when calcium is released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so what is calcium important for in your body that you know about? Bones, making bones strong. All right, but let's take all the calcium in your body and put it just in bones and nowhere else. What won't you be able to do? Muscle contraction, right? So that these calcium ions have to move out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right, and diffuse into this area right here, and that's going to cause sliding of the myofilaments over each other. All right, so what do you think is more important in your body? To have strong bones, if you had to choose, put calcium in bones to make them strong, or put calcium in muscles in order for them to contract? What do you think is more important? At least maybe in the next 5 minutes, what's important for you? Yeah, because what muscle has to be working all the time? Well, we're talking about skeletal muscle, so for breathing is very important, but the same mechanism will work for cardiac muscle as well. So your heart won't beat, your skeletal muscles won't contract unless you have proper calcium in your body. And as we get older, we have a tendency to lose calcium, so guess what decision your body makes for you? Take calcium out of bones, make them weaker, or take calcium out of muscles and make them weaker? Yeah, it finds calcium, takes it out of bone to maintain other functions in your body that are dependent on calcium. So that's just a kind of unfortunate circumstance that we all have to deal with. But how can you protect yourself from that? Have proper calcium in your diet when you're young, right? And vitamin D so that you can absorb it, and then exercise. And the reason why exercise is important, because muscles are going to pull on a bone, and when a bone is stressed, guess what it does? It gets bigger and stronger, which means then it incorporates a lot of calcium so that the reservoir for calcium in your body increases as you get older. So you can afford to lose a lot of bones before they get very weak and start to get brittle and break. Okay, so calcium is very important for muscle contraction. Just think of your heart and also your diaphragm, which is necessary for breathing. Okay, so where is that exam figure at? The exam figure, this one right here. So this is a pretty important exam figure for you to know. Cross-bridge cycling is also dependent on ATP, the energy source. So what else do we have in muscle cells? A lot of mitochondria right here for making ATP. All right, so here is the sarcolemma, which is the cell membrane. Here's the T-tubule that takes that electrical signal deep into the inside of a muscle cell. And when that electrical signal flows next to the sarcoplasmic reticulum by these terminal cisternae right here, it causes the SR to release calcium, and then that causes the filaments to slide over each other, and when the actin and myosin slide over each other, of course, then the sarcomere contracts. When the electrical signal disappears, the sarcoplasmic reticulum takes the calcium out of the myofibril, puts it back in these sacs right here, and then cross bridges can't form, and because of that titin molecule, right, then the cell goes back to its original length as a result of that. So that's muscle contraction. So that's the level that I want you to know something about a muscle. So on this slide right here, where I have excitation contraction coupling. All right, let's look at what actually starts to excite the cell. And that is something that we call the neuromuscular junction, which is on this slide right here. All right, so what do you see right here? What am I circling with the cursor? This is a muscle cell or muscle fiber, right? I see a number of nuclei. I see these striations right here, which is characteristic of skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle. Now, what are these striations due to? Let's see if we can figure that out. What are these striations due to? Yeah, myosin and actin, because remember, myosin is thick. It's thick. It doesn't let a lot of light to pass through it because it's thick and it forms what? A dark band. What do we call a dark band? That is the A band, right? Where you only have actin, it allows a lot of light to pass through it. So what kind of band is that? That's the I band. Okay, that's the I band. And here down underneath this illustration is another one, and you can actually see actin and myosin in a little bit better illustration right here. All right, so here we have that muscle fiber, many nuclei, myofibrils on the inside, but now we see something else. We see a nerve fiber. All right, so here is a neuron, and it's attaching to this muscle fiber. And neurons are specialized to send and transmit electrical impulses very rapidly. From, for instance, maybe from your brain all the way down to the tip of your little finger, if there's a muscle there, very rapidly. And when an electrical signal reaches this axon terminus, right, there is a special junction between the neuron and the muscle cell that we call a synapse. And I don't think we've ever talked about a synapse in here before, have we? No, we haven't. There's two kinds of synapses. But a synapse is a structural and functional unit of communication between two cells. It's how two cells can communicate with each other. So the neuron is going to communicate with this muscle cell right here. Let's look and see how that happens. The electrical signal can't jump from the neuron into the muscle because there's a space between them, and you'll see why we don't really want that to happen in skeletal muscle cells. So when the electrical signal reaches this end of a neuron, right, you see that it kind of has a little swelling right here. And let's zoom into this area. So here is a little swelling. Sometimes we call that a synaptic button or a synaptic bouton or bouton terminale. You know, in anatomy, sometimes things have a lot of different names, right? Because it contains a lot of different structures. It contains these vesicles. These vesicles are filled with a chemical compound that we call a neurotransmitter. It's a neurotransmitter because what cell is it in? It's in a neuron. Okay? All right, so when an electrical signal comes down, it then causes the fusing of these vesicles to the cell membrane at the end of this axon. And when the vesicle fuses, whatever inside these vesicles gets exocytosed into the space between the neuron and the muscle cell. So it's like a secretory pathway or exocytosis, but it's controlled by that electrical signal. And that neurotransmitter then moves from the neuron over to the muscle cell by diffusion, going from high concentration to low concentration. And when that chemical bumps into the cell membrane of the muscle cell, then the muscle cell starts another electrical impulse. And in a physiology class, you'll learn and see how that happens. So information moves across the synapse as a chemical signal. So let's just look at how information goes. Information moves through the neuron as an electrical signal. It moves over the surface of a muscle as an electrical signal, but how does it move from the neuron onto the muscle cell? It moves not as an electrical signal, but as a chemical signal, right? And that chemical signal, the general name is what we call a neurotransmitter. Between a neuron and a muscle, it's always going to be a chemical that we call acetylcholine, or ACH. That's very particular. Okay, so that space between the neuron and the muscle cell is what we call the synaptic cleft, because this is a synapse, and the kind of synapse, because the signal goes from an electrical signal in the neuron to a chemical signal across the synapse, back into an electrical signal on the muscle cell. We call that a chemical synapse because it uses a neurotransmitter between these two cells right here. Okay. Let me see if there's another slide that I want to show you. Okay. I think this is the best one that we can look at. All right. Here is another detail. Oh, here's that calcium. Where's this calcium coming from? The sarcoplasmic reticulum. Oh, okay, let's take it from the top. So here we have an electrical signal coming down a neuron. And it reaches this terminal button right here, or axon terminus. It's going to cause this vesicle to move over to the cell membrane and release neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. And let me just tell you one other thing that is involved with that. When the electrical signal comes down, it allows calcium to enter from the extracellular material into the neuron. And it's the calcium that enters the neuron right here that causes the movement of neurotransmitter out of the cell. Right? And then the neurotransmitter sets up another electrical signal in the muscle. So if we were to take calcium out of your body and put it in bones, then the calcium can't enter this nerve right here to release neurotransmitter. What's going to happen to the communication between the neuron and the muscle cell if we take all the calcium away? There'll be no communication between those two cells. So the transmission of information from this neuron into the muscle cell is also dependent on calcium. So we call that synaptic transmission. So without calcium, synaptic transmission can't even occur. And this is the way that most cells communicate with each other. So without proper calcium in your body, your brain can't function either. So without proper calcium, muscles can't contract, nerves can't communicate with each other, and furthermore, nerves can't even communicate with muscles. So if you were to have a choice of where you want to put calcium, do you want to have proper calcium, for instance, in muscles and the extracellular space, or do you want it in your bones to make bones strong? Muscles and nerves, so that they function, right? So as we get older, the thing that really takes a hit is bones, and you probably agree that that's the proper decision, but you still need to protect yourself from that happening, if possible. Okay, question. Okay. Inside the cells, no matter if it's a neuron or a muscle cell, there's typically very low calcium, okay? And that means that there is high calcium outside the cell. Muscles have a little bit of a different architecture. Inside the cell, there's a special little place where calcium is stored, but it can't float around in the cytosol. It's stored inside this organelle, which is the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. So again, typically there's very low calcium inside the muscle cell, except this organelle, and there's very low calcium inside of a nerve cell, but it's high on the outside of the cell. So when the electrical signal comes down, it allows calcium to enter, and that controls the positioning of these vesicles, moves them over to the cell membrane right here so that it exocytoses neurotransmitter. Okay, so calcium is important for synaptic transmission, but it's also important for cross-bridge cycling within a sarcomere. So it's important for synaptic transmission as well as sliding of myofilaments over each other. It's a special kind of little communication scheme that's used. All right, and in your book, I don't see some of these other molecules anymore. Okay, for instance, on the slides, I talk about a molecule called troponin. All right, do I talk about tropomyosin right here? So you shouldn't have any questions on troponin or tropomyosin, but when we get into a physiology class, we'll be interested in troponin and tropomyosin because those are some components. Oh, where's that figure at? Under here someplace? Rats. Where did it go? Ah, here it is. Okay, troponin and tropomyosin are part of the actin molecule. And that's what activates the actin molecule so that myosin can bind to it. And tropomyosin is just one molecule that is very sensitive to calcium. And when calcium is floating around these filaments right here, tropomyosin is sensitive to it, and then myosin can bind and the filaments can slide over each other. All right, so you should just cross off troponin and tropomyosin, unless I bring it up in another part of the class. Okay, so that figure was kind of deleted from this new edition of the textbook. Okay, one last thing I think we want to talk about in this chapter is the concept of a motor unit. And we're going to look at cardiac muscle and then kind of wrap the muscle chapter up. Okay, so for a motor unit, let's look at, I think this slide is a good one right here. All right, so let's look at this slide, and we see a section of the spinal cord. Spinal cord looks like this. I don't see any bone, so the vertebral column is not anywhere to be found on this diagram. It's just the spinal cord. And where does the spinal cord fit in the nervous system? Did we talk about that? I think maybe we did. Central nervous system has two parts to it, the brain and the spinal cord, so that's one part of the central nervous system. All right, so a nerve will leave the central nervous system and go out to a muscle. All right, and these nerves right here are under your voluntary control. You can send signals out through these nerves or not. They're going to be controlled by your brain. All right, but before it gets to a skeletal muscle, what can it do? It can branch off. So I see two different kinds of neurons, and since these are taking signals to muscles to cause them to contract, we call these motor neurons because they're going to cause these muscles to act like a little motor to contract. All right, so this blue neuron, how many muscle cells does this blue neuron go to? I see one here and one here. So this is what we define as a motor unit. One motor neuron, and then all of the cells or muscle fibers that are innervated. So when there's a signal to contract coming down this motor neuron, only this muscle fiber will contract and this one right here. Only those two. All right? And that's going to produce a certain amount of tension. Now let's look at the red neuron. And we'll call that motor unit number two. Here's the red one. And how many muscle cells does it go to? It goes to three. One, two, three. So when a signal for contraction moves down this neuron right here, will it produce a stronger or an identical contraction or a weaker contraction compared to if only the blue neuron sends information? Stronger, right? 50% stronger because, right, there is an additional muscle fiber that contracts right there. All right, so this is a way that your body can control the strength of contraction when a muscle contracts by recruiting or stimulating just a proper number of motor units. So a motor unit is one motor neuron and all the muscle fibers that are controlled by that particular neuron. All right, so there's some parts of your body that you have very fine control over, which means that you have one motor neuron going to just a couple muscle fibers, so it produces a very weak contraction. And then if you need just a little bit stronger contraction, what can you do? Then your mind will pick another motor unit to cause it to contract, and it'll be a little bit stronger. And if you need just a little bit stronger contraction, then you can recruit, three motor units, as opposed to other parts of your body where you do not need fine control. For instance, where do you need fine control? Facial muscles and hands, right? So you can grab something with a lot of force or very delicately if you're doing a very delicate job. Other parts of your body where you don't need fine control would be like postural muscles in your back, because you don't have anything important in terms of dexterity with your back, so you have very large motor units. You have one neuron maybe going to thousands of muscle fibers that all contract at the same time, which then support your body weight. Okay, so the motor unit is very important. The other thing is that if we stimulate one motor unit, it doesn't then stimulate other motor units to contract in a skeletal muscle, which is fantastic. Because if one motor neuron stimulated a whole muscle to contract, for instance, if I reach for a bottle and grabbed it, and I sent a signal out to my biceps to contract very weakly to raise a small bottle of water, what would happen if all of those muscle fibers in that biceps contracted at the same time? It would be a huge contraction, right? And I could poke my eye out, or the water bottle would be flying across the room. And maybe you even have done that in a restaurant by mistake. Okay? Have you ever had like a big tumbler with ice water in it, big mug, and you grab it and lift it up, and all of a sudden it starts flying off the table because you thought that that mug was made out of glass, but it's really plastic? Right, so you had an impression and your mind was thinking, oh, it's real heavy, I need to use a lot of muscle, but you don't. All right, but fortunately, you probably caught yourself before that happened. All right, and that's because these signals are transmitted only under this neuromuscular junction right here as a chemical signal. So one muscle fiber can be stimulated and independent from the one next to it. Because those chemicals, the neurotransmitter, when it's released from the neuron, only goes to one muscle fiber. That's a pretty important consideration. All right, so be familiar with what the definition of a motor unit is. Let's contrast that a little bit with a cardiac muscle. And where's cardiac muscle? Cardiac muscle. Okay, cardiac muscle. Here is sort of an okay example of cardiac muscle right here. All right, so remember the three kinds of muscle are skeletal, cardiac, and smooth. And we've kind of looked at the histology already, but I don't want to go back and open up that chapter. So here is a cardiac muscle. Notice that it is short. What do we call the endpoints of a cardiac muscle, these terminations right here? Intercalated discs. Right, so a cardiac muscle is short compared to a skeletal muscle, which is long. Right? The other difference is that a skeletal muscle is long and linear. It's just a straight tube. But what can you tell me about this cardiac muscle right here? It's short, but it is also branched. You see this little branch right here? Here's another branch. And so here's another branch. So all these cells are connected to each other laterally by these intercalated discs, and also from on top of each other to below each other by these little branches right here. So this is a special kind of muscle that does not have a chemical synapse, it has an electrical synapse. So there are very few organs in your body that have electrical synapses. And it just, the electrical synapses are due to gap junctions in these intercalated discs. So if one cardiac muscle cell is stimulated, right, electrically, that electrical signal can move to the cell in front of it, it can move to the cell behind it through the gap junctions in this intercalated disc, causing this first cell to contract, but it's also going to cause the one behind it and in front of it to contract at the same time. But what else is going to happen? Because of these branch points, it's going to cause the cells below it to contract, which then cause, because of more branching, cause what? The whole thickness of the heart wall to contract, as well as the whole length of the heart to contract. So the difference between cardiac muscle and skeletal muscle is when one cell in the heart is excited or told to contract, what does the whole heart do? It contracts as a unit. And that's very important for pumping blood. In order for the heart to pump blood, it's got to squeeze down blood everywhere around the whole circumference of the heart, from the tip up to the base of the heart, in order for blood to be pumped. And that's because we have chemical synapses in these intercalated discs, and because there are branch points between different cells. All right, so that's an electrical synapse. Now, what would happen if all of our skeletal muscles had electrical synapses instead of chemical synapses? So what happens if we were to tell one cell to contract, and there are electrical synapses between every skeletal muscle cell in your body? What would happen? You'd reach to grab a pencil or something, and every single skeletal muscle cell in your body would contract. And would that be very efficient? No, you couldn't control your body whatsoever. So in skeletal muscle, we have chemical synapses, but in the heart, because we want it to contract as a unit, we have electrical synapses. So electricity can go from one cell to another. And later on, we might learn about smooth muscle. Depends on what kind of smooth muscle it is. It has some characteristics of both cardiac and skeletal muscle. Okay, I will probably have to talk a little bit about smooth muscle next time, because we moved the figure away out of this chapter right here. Okay, now in Blackboard, there's some really good videos that actually show excitation-contraction coupling, that show sliding of myofilaments, and the cycling of cross bridges, how ATP is used. So I would certainly look at those. Oh, one thing about Blackboard. Well, I think I mentioned this at the beginning of class, but if not, let me mention it again. The quiz seems to be working with Firefox as a browser, but for some sections, you can't take a quiz using Internet Explorer. So you have to download Mozilla Firefox. The website is in an announcement, but I sent an email out to everybody as well. Maybe I want to check somebody's email before you leave class today, make sure it's in there correctly. So use Mozilla Firefox for quizzes, or maybe Chrome. You can try Chrome, which is the Google browser. I don't have any experience with Chrome. But if people like it, all I have to do is click to get it to work. And the sign-in sheet. Who's got the sign-in sheet? It's right here? Oh, good. Did I hit pause somewhere? I guess I did.